Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med mediehuset Ingeniøren, Automatikmessen Automatik og IDA Forsikring. Jeg hedder Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. Det er blevet utrolig moderne at være kritisk over for teknologi. I løbet af sommeren så har den franske præsident Macron opfyldt sit valgløfte og forbudt mobiltelefoner på franske skoler. Så efter sommerferien der skal franske skoleelever spille bold i frikvarteret og høre efter i timerne, i stedet for at swipe rundt på smartphones. Man kunne fristes til at tro, at Macron og hans partistøtter har læst den amerikanske tech-kritiker og forfatter Nicolas Carr, der i foråret slog smut omkring Kunstmuseet Louisiana i Nordsjælland til en samtale om teknologikritik. Jeg lukkede ham også ind i Tektopias studie til en snak omkring fem begreber for teknologiernes verden. Dem vender vi tilbage til om lidt. Først så skal vi nemlig lige have præsenteret Nicolas Carr.
My name is Nicolas Carr. I'm a writer from the United States. I tend to write about technology and its effects on culture and society and all of us as individuals. I've written several books on that, looking at that topic from different angles. One of the books, probably the best known, is called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. In my most recent book, which is a collection of essays I've written for various publications, is called Utopia is Creepy.
Nicolas Carrs seneste bog har titlen Utopia is Creepy, og det er en samling af hans tekster gennem tiden. Indlæg fra hans blog Rough Type, essays som Is Google Making Us Stupid? Og Life, Liberty and the Pursuit of Privacy, samt længere artikler fra tidsskrifter. De har alle sammen det til fælles, at de er meget kritiske over for, hvordan vi bruger tech, hvordan teknologi bruger os, og hvad den gør ved os som mennesker, og hvordan magtforholdet er mellem tech-forbrugeren og de virksomheder, som laver, sælger og kontrollerer teknologien. Gennem et årti som tech-kritiker har Nicolas Carr udgivet tre bøger. The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, The Glass Cage, How Our Computers Are Changing Us, og så The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. Men hvad satte ham egentlig i gang som tech-kritiker, for han er jo faktisk en af de allerførste?
Yeah, about 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, I had been a writer, a journalist about and a writer about technology for a number of years and had been quite enthusiastic. I actually quite enjoy technology in including computer technology. I'd spent a lot of time with computers, a lot of time on the internet. But then I began to notice I was having trouble paying attention. I was having trouble concentrating. In my mind seemed to be wanting to gather information and data and be stimulated all the time. And I realized I all my time online seemed to have trained my mind to be distracted and to want to keep shifting focus rather than concentrate on things. And I got very worried about this because I think the ability to be reflective and contemplative is very important. And so that's what made me concerned about how important computer technology, digital technology was becoming in our lives, and how it might have, for all the benefits we get, how it might have effects on us, deep effects on us, that we might come to regret.
And then you started writing, but have you done other things to sort of prevent this state of what would you say, state of mind or state of being that you have experienced?
Most of what I've been doing to try to influence the public or else encourage other people to kind of think critically about technology. I write a lot and I give quite a number of speeches and talks. In my own personal life, I still struggle to get a proper balance because I use the internet and Google and stuff a lot for research as a writer, and I feel myself pulled into this kind of compulsive mode of information gathering that I find to be very destructive. So I continue to struggle with the technology myself, but I do agree that, you know, 10 years ago when I started writing about this, there weren't many people raising concerns, and now, for all sorts of reasons, a lot of the public is much more worried about the technology and its influence. I'm not sure that those worries are getting people to change the way they behave, but I think we're more aware of the problems the technology is creating.
Ja, det startede med, at han ikke kunne koncentrere sig. Han opdagede, at det var teknologien, der forstyrrede mere, den gavnede, når han prøvede at arbejde og lave research til bøger og artikler på nettet. Men i stedet for at lave et traditionelt interview med Nicolas Carr om hans seneste bog, ja, så valgte jeg fem ord eller paradigmer for at se, hvad de sætter i gang i hans hjerne, der som hans læsere vil vide, er stærkt plaget af det moderne informationsbombardement. De fem ord, jeg valgte, er data, hastighed, hjernen, the big five, og her taler vi altså om Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple og Microsoft, og til sidst begrebet singulariteten, altså ideen om, at kunstig intelligens vil forandre eller måske overtage verden totalt om få årtier. Det første ord, jeg stikker Nicolas Carr, er data. Hvad sætter det i gang i hovedet på ham?
I've recently been thinking about how Silicon Valley and technology firms and kind of conceive of human beings as the data, because that's what they want to do. They want to, you know, they deal in data, and the more that they can turn us into a data profile, the easier we are to work with, and certainly the easier they are to package us up and kind of sell us to advertisers. I'm interested in the metaphor metaphors we use to describe this relationship between human beings as human beings and human beings as data. And often, I think the favorite metaphor for a long time has been the mine, data mining. So the idea is that we are these piles of data that is then extracted from us as oil is extracted from the earth, or as, you know, gold or coal is extracted. And to me, that's not quite right. I would argue, because it seems to imply that data just sits in us passively. But the reality is that we create data that's of interest to the technology companies, through everything we do every day. What we look at, who we talk to, where we go. And so I think a better metaphor is that we're not data mines, we're data factories, we're producers of data. And the reason that's important, I think, is because that means that when you start to think of us as these laborers who are creating data, that means that the tech companies not only want to extract data from us, but they want to shape the way we behave, so that they can get this data from us. So I think a lot of the software we use, a lot of the social media services we use, essentially look at us as data laborers and kind of want to steer our thoughts and our behavior into patterns that are easier to draw data out of. And I think the idea of a human being as a data factory gets much closer to the breadth of influence and sometimes manipulation that we find when we go online or when we use computers or apps or social media.
Social media virksomheder, e-handelssites eller film- og musiksites og app-udviklere, ja, de opfatter alle sammen mennesker som en slags kødpose fuld af data, som kan købes og sælges og udnyttes. De opfatter data som en ressource, der kan trækkes ud af os, som olie, kul eller guld. Men det er helt forkert, mener Nicolas Carr, fordi data er ikke en passiv ressource. Tværtimod så skaber vi data konstant, så det giver mere mening at sammenligne os med fabrikker, som bearbejder råvarer, end at sammenligne os med råvaren selv. Vi er datafabrikker, fordi vi skaber data hele tiden. Derfor så vil virksomhederne styre vores opførsel, og gennem deres software styre os til at gøre bestemte ting. Vi skal skabe bestemte typer data og mønstre af data, som er nemmere at udnytte kommercielt. Men hvis vi er dataskabere, Hvordan kan vi så skabe data, som vi selv kan bestemme over? Hvordan kan vi kontrollere vores egen strøm af data?
I think when we start thinking of ourselves as data producers, it very much raises the question of who controls us. Who controls us? Who owns the data we produce? What are the how do we negotiate the relationships between ourselves and companies that would like to exploit that data? And so it certainly points to the complexities of questions of ownership, questions of control, questions of manipulation. But as you say, it opens up the possibility that kind of the traditional view that it was very easy for companies to kind of do whatever they wanted, essentially, with us and our data, that's probably not the best relationship we should have.
Moores lov fortæller os, at regnekraften i computerchips fordobles cirka hver andet år til samme pris. Man taler om, at teknologien har en accelererende effekt på resten af samfundet. Derfor så er det andet ord til Nicolas Carr, hastighed.
Well, speed, I think it's fair to say that our lives, people's lives have been speeding up in terms of just processing more information, doing more things, moving about much more quickly for a long time now. For most of modern times. And I think that acceleration of everything really picked up with the arrival of mass media 100, 150 years ago. And if you look at studies that show kind of the time that anything takes, or the length of anything, you see everything getting shorter and shorter and shorter, whether it's newspaper stories or advertisements pretty much everything is kind of getting more and more compressed. And I think what's happened is that whole trend has accelerated a great deal digital media and computers have taken over more and more of the function of delivering information and entertainment and news and everything to us. And as a result, I think what we're losing is a capacity for patience because we're so busy collecting information and having information pushed to us through notifications and updates and alerts and kind of this constant sense that there's new stuff out there on our phone, usually on our phone that we want to tap into, that it changes. It's really changing the tempo, the pace of our day-to-day lives. In a way, I think that leaves very, very, very little room for slowing down, concentrating on things, being attentive to things, being contemplative and reflective and introspective. And unfortunately, I think it's very, very hard, and I think this is pretty clear from studies of how our minds work, it's very, very hard to think deeply, coherently, critically, when you're constantly processing new information. I think this is one of the great problems. This is something I've written about for a long time now. One of the great problems we face is that we've entered this new digital environment which is very good at bombarding us with lots of information, lots of data, but very bad at giving us the space and time required to turn that information into knowledge.
Vores liv speeder op, og denne acceleration har stået på siden massemediernes tidsalder startede for cirka 150 år siden. Al information, det bliver serveret i kortere og kortere bidder, den bliver komprimeret, og de digitale medier sætter mere fart i den tendens. Derfor så mister vi vores evne til at have tålmodighed, fordi alting konstant bliver skubbet ind i hovedet på os. Det skaber også en forventning om, at vi skal opleve og have ny information hele tiden. Denne konstante tilstand af at blive forstyrret, gør det meget svært at tænke dybt, kritisk og sammenhængende, fordi man hele tiden skal behandle ny information. Vi er gode til at lade os bombardere med information, men vi er også rigtig dårlige til at lave den information om til viden, påpeger Carr. Carr, han er også gammel guitarist, så jeg prøver at rulle tiden tilbage til 1990'erne, hvor en af mine kollegaer havde en guitar stående på redaktionen, fordi det var så hyggeligt at spille lidt guitar, mens man ventede på, at en hjemmeside skulle komme frem på skærmen. I dag skal et website helst loade på højst et kvart sekund, før vi bliver irriteret og klikker væk igen.
Not so long ago, back in the days when the websites took still, you know, before broadband was available everywhere and things moved a little more slowly, there was something called the 4-second rule, which companies, you know, online retailers, other companies, the companies that wanted you to stay on their site, they said, you know, if something took 4 seconds to load, or information took 4 seconds to get to you, then you'd leave and go somewhere else. So they had to deliver information. They had to make sure they delivered information within a new web page or whatever within 4 seconds, or a person would get impatient, you know, click on a link and go somewhere else. Recently, it turns out the recent studies, and Microsoft has done one of these studies, it turns out that's no longer 4 seconds. It's a quarter of a second. We start getting nervous and impatient if we just have to wait a fraction of a second for the new thing we're waiting for to appear online. And you see this also as well with studies of online videos, particularly YouTube videos. There's a massive study that showed that as our connections, as our broadband connections speed up, our patience with waiting for a video to start goes way, way down. So as the network speeds up, we continually lose our patience.
I gamle dage, for et år 10 siden, der arbejdede man med 4-sekundsreglen. Hvis man ikke fik sin information på skærmen inden for 4 sekunder, så var man væk igen. Den nyeste forskning fra Microsoft viser, at den tid er faldet til et kvart sekund. Ifølge Kara, så falder vores tålmodighed i takt med, at netværkshastigheden stiger. Jo hurtigere vores internet er, desto mindre tålmodighed har vi. Det bringer os helt naturligt frem til at se på, hvad det gør ved vores hjerner. Så det tredje ord til Nicolas Carr er hjernen.
Well, I think there's been a fundamental error in the assumptions that tech companies, what I'll call Silicon Valley, Google, Facebook, all the rest. I think they've built their businesses on a very simple and in some ways idealistic assumption, which is that information and knowledge are essentially the same thing. So, and therefore, the more information they can deliver to us and the faster they can deliver it to us, the better off we'll all be, they believe. They believe that just increasing the volume of information available to somebody will make that person more informed, more thoughtful, more broad-minded. But what we're learning is that that's not true at all, and it can actually have the opposite effect. And the reason, I think, is that information is the raw material of knowledge, personal knowledge, but it requires a complex... Your brain has to go through a complex process to turn that raw information, that raw material, into knowledge, into deep thoughts. And that process is basically a memory process. It's taking new information that comes in, you know, through our eyes or whatever, that however we get it, which comes into what's called working memory, basically our conscious mind, and then transferring it into our long-term memory, a process called memory consolidation. And it's only through that process, memory consolidation, that we connect the new information with other facts we've learned and other experiences we've had and other emotions we've felt. And it's those connections, those rich connections and associations among all sorts of information inside our minds that is the source of knowledge. And that gives us the ability to think conceptually and deeply and interestingly about anything. And what we know about the process is it really hinges on attention, that you have to concentrate and think deeply about information to associate it with other pieces of information in your mind to build knowledge. And if you're constantly bombarded by information, if you're constantly shifting your focus, you've got new notifications, you've got new messages coming in, new Facebook updates or whatever, then you're so perpetually distracted and you're processing so much information that you can't attend to any one given piece of information, even the very important stuff. And as a result, you're not creating those rich connections and associations. Your intellect begins to flatten out. We've created this system that gives us immense amounts of information, but actually instead of increasing our knowledge and our intellect, I think it actually decreases those and makes us very, very quick to process information, but very weak when it comes to making sense of things and to putting new information into a broader conceptual framework.
Silicon Valley bygger på en forestilling om, at information og viden er det samme. Jo hurtigere information kan leveres, desto bedre går det for os. Men ens hjerne skal igennem en proces, hvor information laves om til viden. Information skal flyttes fra arbejdshukommelsen til langtidshukommelsen, hvor ny information skal forbindes med kendte fakta og erfaring, og det er i den proces, at ny information laves om til ny viden, som vi kan bruge. På den måde kan vi tænke dybt og konceptuelt, men hvis vores fokus forstyrres af social media, ja, så kan vi ikke lave de forbindelser i hjernen, og så flader vores viden ud. Vi bliver gode til at overskue store mængder information, men dårligere til at sætte den information sammen til viden. Could you imagine any tools that you could use so you would counter this development? Still being digital, but
there are. I think even a lot of software programmers are worried about this and see this. So you see various apps and other tools that you can download now that will for instance turn off or block you from using the net or block you from using social media for a certain amount of time. So are basically ways to use software to impose, to give you the will that you lack when it comes to using these services. And in fact, Apple, I think, is in its upcoming new operating system is actually embedding some of these tools that alerts you to how much time you've spent on social media, or I think you can set limits and it'll remind you that you've gone over for the day. I'm not sure that those are effective, because I think the pull of information in the way, you know, social media and other things are designed, it's really designed to make us feel compulsive in gathering information. So even if we have these tools available to regulate the flow of information, I wonder whether very many people will actually use them over a longer period of time.
Næste begreb er The Big Five. Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple og Microsoft. Og her fortæller jeg lige først Nicolas Carr, at Danmark som det første land i verden har en tech-ambassadør, fordi den danske regering mener, at de store IT-virksomheder er så magtfulde, at de skal behandles som stater.
Yeah, and so I think normally the Big Five refers to Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft and Apple, which are enormous companies now and really do to a great degree control the flow of digital media, which is basically now the dominant form of media. But they each compete in different ways. And you look at how Facebook makes money is quite different from Apple, certainly quite different from Amazon. Microsoft is kind of doing its own thing now. So we have these five very big companies. And I would argue that they're competing at the edges of their businesses, but they have their basic way of making money is protected from each other. You know, Amazon being in retailing, Apple being in very much in hardware, Facebook being social media, Google being in search, and I forgot the other one. But what we have is that these huge companies are increasingly protected from competition. And it's going to be very hard. they've kind of gotten, you know, not so much a monopoly, but kind of an oligopoly, I think that's the right word, where they've kind of carved up this very, very large world of media and business and technology. And they're pretty protected. And it's very, very hard for, you know, a small entrepreneurial company to come and attack one of these. The best that most, you know, small companies hope for is that one of these companies will buy them. And I think that's a dangerous situation. And I think, you know, paradoxically, it's interesting to look at something like the recent new European privacy regulations. Is it GDPR?
GDPR.
Because on the one hand, you know, I think they're very important, and they provide consumer protections and provide more transparency and put penalties on these companies for abusing their positions. On the other hand, these are very complex regulations. It requires a lot of time and money to obey them. And what we've done is, you know, companies like Google and Facebook, they have huge amounts of money. They have lots of lawyers. They have lots of technical staff. They can obey these regulations very, very easily. But for smaller companies, it's actually a bigger burden to obey these regulations. So paradoxically or ironically, these kind of regulations, they might be very, very good, but they also actually give more power to the big companies because it makes it even harder for other companies to compete against them. They're kind of entrenching these five big power centers even further. And after a while, you know, they do start to look kind of like nation states or even cross nation states. And Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, kind of uses that language. I don't think if you came out and asked him, are you trying to replace a nation state, he would say yes. But when you look at the language he uses, and he wrote this manifesto last year, he very much said that, you know, we're interested in connecting people across nations, across geographies. And he said it in a way that really did imply this kind of supranational kind of new digital state. And he'll be, of course, the one person in charge of it, which is kind of a scary thought.
I believe he calls it a community, but a community consisting of, I think, around 2 billion people.
Over 2 billion people. Yes, he loves the word community. And he thinks, you know, I said that there's this assumption that information is the same as knowledge. There's also this assumption, very much in Facebook and other places, that communication is the same as community. So that the more we communicate, the more we express ourselves and other people express ourselves and we see what they're saying, that automatically creates better communities in Zuckerberg's view, and, you know, more social harmony. But that is not true of human nature at all. And in fact, that explains why there's so much tension and friction and polarization in the world today. Often when other people communicate to us, we like them less than we did before when we learn more about them. And you can read studies of this. It's absolutely true. It's simply a fantasy to think that simply getting people to talk more about themselves will lead to better understanding and empathy and more social harmony. That too could have exactly the opposite effect.
Det er sandt, at de fem virksomheder kontrollerer mediestrømmen med vores apparater, men de konkurrerer på forskellige måder ude på kanten af deres respektive forretningsområder. Deres måde at lave penge på er forskellige, og dermed er de på en måde beskyttet mod hinanden. De har på den facon delt verden mellem sig, og det gør det svært for nye mindre virksomheder at komme ind på markedet, så i stedet for at konkurrere, så håber man på at blive købt af dem. Og på samme måde så ender EU's nye persondataforordning, GDPR, ifølge Karma ikke at betyde så meget for The Big Five. De har mange penge, advokater og teknologieksperter, så reguleringen er ikke svær at leve op til. Faktisk så går det mere ud over de små virksomheder, der ikke har de samme ressourcer. Men hvis man lytter til Facebooks stifter og direktør Mark Zuckerberg og læser hans manifest, så opfatter han faktisk sit firma som en slags overnational fællesskab, hvilket ifølge Carr ligger i naturlig forlængelse af tankegang i Silicon Valley, som mener, at kommunikation er det samme som community, altså fællesskab. Men det er ikke sandt, siger han. Forskning har vist, at vi faktisk synes mindre og mindre om folk, jo mere de kommunikerer med os. Og al den snak om Silicon Valley-virksomheder, det leder os frem til begrebet singulariteten, det sidste ord, jeg vil give til Nicolas Carr. Den fremmeste fortaler for singulariteten, det er forfatter og opfinder Ray Kurzweil, som i dag har en chefstilling hos Google, hvor han arbejder med kunstig intelligens. Han er også medstifter af kursusvirksomheden Singularity University i Googles hjemby Mountain View, hvor folk fra hele verden betaler for dyre kurser og tips til at tænke i disruption, som de gør det i Silicon Valley. Singulariteten er blevet en forretning, men ifølge Kurzweil så er den et punkt i menneskehedens historie, hvor Moores lov, kombineret med Kurzweils egne tanker om teknologiens accelererende afkast, vil skabe en kunstig intelligens, som vil gennemsyre vores liv, ja ligefrem overtage verden, og forhåbentlig skabe et utopia, hvor problemer som dødelige sygdomme og miljøproblemer, ja selv døden, bliver løst. Kurzweil mente tidligere, at den her tilstand det vil indtræffe i år 2045, men for nylig der ændrede han datoen til 2029, måske fordi den så ligger inden for rækkevidde i hans egen livstid. Hvorom alt er, så er singulariteten en god forretning i Silicon Valley, men hvad tænker en kritiker som Nicholas Carr?
I think it's another expression of kind of over this kind of arrogant, overreaching, almost messianic quality of technology leaders in Silicon Valley. They're so in love with technology that, you know, and sometimes they present this in a dark light, and sometimes they present it as a utopian thing, but they love to talk about computers taking over, computers becoming conscious and becoming smarter than human beings. And even when they present doomsday scenarios, I think underlying it is this kind of real kind of desire for this to happen. And I have to say, I don't think it's going to happen. I would not worry about computers having a human-like intelligence that's inferior to ours, much less superior. And the reason is because in order for computers or any machines to take on that kind of, to gain that intelligence and to kind of take on that kind of power, they have to have self-awareness of some kind. They have to have some kind of consciousness. They have to be aware that they're thinking and making decisions, so that they have their own will and so forth. And there's absolutely no evidence that that is taking place at all. I mean, when you think about it, for years and years now, computers and computer networks have been leaping ahead at a very, very fast pace, have been getting much, much better, much, much faster. And yet there's not any single, even tiniest indication of any self-awareness, any consciousness in a machine. And so I think there are plenty of things to worry about it when it comes to what we today call artificial intelligence, things like machine learning, very powerful tools. But I think this idea of a singularity where computers, you know, replace us as the most intelligent beings in the world, I think that's just a fantasy, because I don't think computers are beings, and I don't think they're becoming beings. And I might be wrong, but I think it remains a fantasy.
Singulariteten er et arrogant udtryk for en pseudo-religiøs frelsertankegang. Et utopia, hvor computere overtager og bliver klogere end mennesker. Carr opfatter tankegangen som menneskefjendsk, fordi man sætter maskinen over mennesket. I nogle tilfælde virker det faktisk på ham, som om singularisterne også har en fantasi om, at en dystopisk fremtid med maskiner i førersædet faktisk er mere ønskværdig end den tilstand, vi har lige nu. Men han tror til gengæld ikke på, at det sker, fordi det kræver, at den kunstige intelligens skal udvikle en bevidsthed, og det er der lige nu ikke nogen tegn på, at det vil ske, trods accelerationen i teknologi. Der er rigtig mange ting, man kan bekymre sig om med teknologi, men singulariteten, den tror han er en fantasi. Computer bliver ikke bevidste, men han tilføjer dog, at han kan jo tage fejl. One of the concepts within the singularity of thinking, and also something that has gained a lot of interest in creative companies in Silicon Valley, is longevity, the idea of living, if not forever, then at least for a very long time, and being sort of young and so on. How does this fit in with the other concepts that you write about?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a good question. And again, I think it also relates back to this arrogance of the technologists, and it's a very, you know, it's a very bizarre. I think it's an expression of almost, I think there's a misanthropy, a kind of hatred of humanness that runs under the surface of a lot of Silicon Valley. And I think that's another expression of it, that there's something horrible about the human body and that it breaks down and that it's not there forever. And you know, there's this kind of there's this desire that the human body could somehow be more of a engineered artifact than a biological artifact. And the problem with that is, of course, that it removes what makes us human from us. And certainly death is as much a part of what makes us human as birth. But they don't seem to see that. I mean, I think it's an expression of a desire to what they would call liberating the human mind or the human brain from the human body. Because I basically don't think they like humanness.
Et centralt element i Kurzweils tanker er udødelighed, eller i det mindste at besejre dræbere som cancer og Alzheimer, og give os et længere liv med et bedre helbred. Ifølge Nicolas Carr, ja, så er vi igen tilbage ved de arrogante teknologer. Under overfladen i Silicon Valley eksisterer der en foragt for mennesker, fordi kroppen er forgængelig. Teknologerne vil gerne gøre kroppen til et ingeniørprojekt, som de kan kontrollere, frem for et stykke biologi. Jeg tror slet ikke, at de kan lide menneskeheden, lyder hans dom. Så er det derfor, hans bog hedder Utopia is Creepy?
I'm talking specifically about many of the portrayals of a future utopia that you see. And these portrayals seem very sterile, that everything works perfectly. Everybody's connected all the time. We're wrapped up in information flows. And when you look at them in some of the tech companies like to come out with kind of promotional videos about this future where everything is like very efficient and everything is computer controlled and optimized. And when you look at the human beings in these so-called utopian worlds, they really look like robots. They, you know, all the things that give us emotion, that give us passion, that make us, you know, make us into fallible, flawed, but also interesting creatures, they're all taken away. So it really seems, you know, in the ideal of perfecting the world, the ideal of perfecting the world is also an ideal of eradicating the human spirit, I think.
Utopia er creepy, fordi teknologernes idé om et utopia er en steril verden, hvor alt er effektivt, computeriseret og optimeret, og alle ligner og opfører sig som en computer. Dette ideal om en perfekt verden er også ideen om at udslette menneskets ånd, lyder de sidste ord fra Nicolas Carr. Thank you for participating in Techtopia.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Vi slukker mikrofonerne, og jeg fortæller ham, at jeg faktisk har været på kursus på Singularity University og mødt Ray Kurzweil flere gange, og at biologi måske er moderne ingeniørkunst. Jeg kan se, at Carr bliver en smule utryg ved mig, men i vores tilfælde så fører kommunikation faktisk til fællesskab. Vi mødes nemlig ikke online, vi mødes fysisk, og vi drikker et par øl, mens vi finder ud af, at vi begge to har spillet guitar i punkbands i 1980'erne, da vi var unge, og vi begge to har et svagt punkt for Lou Reed. Og på den måde så lander vi et sted, hvor vi kan være sammen. Jeg linker til Nicolas Carrs blog Rough Type for techtopia.dk. Du kan diskutere teknologi med mig og 950 andre på Techtopia Backstage, der ironisk nok er en gruppe på Facebook. Du kan også skrive til mig på henrik@techtopia.dk og følge @techtopia.dk på Twitter. Techtopia udkommer hver mandag på genhør. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med mediehuset Ingeniøren, Automatikmessen Automatik og IDA Forsikring. Jeg hedder Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia. Techtopia.